of alleged Downing Street parties. After handing back a questionnaire to the Metropolitan Police, which is expected to defend his presence at some of the dozen events under investigation, the Prime Minister dodged a series of questions about the issue. Asked if he would quit if Scotland Yard issued him with a fixed penalty notice worth at least £100, Boris Johnson told BBC's Sunday morning programme, "I can't comment about a process that is already underway." He said he would have something meaningful to say about this when the Metropolitan Police investigation ended, but insisted that any answers now would be interpreted as a point of commentary about the process. Boris Johnson added he hoped people won't have long, but said, "There's not a jot I can say until it's done." Previously, the Prime Minister has commented on specific events, including a bring-your-own-bottle garden party to which more than 100 Downing Street staff were invited. The gathering was held on 20th of May 2020, when only two people from different households could meet outdoors, socially distanced. Last month, Boris Johnson denied any wrongdoing and claimed technically no rules were broken and that he thought it was a work event.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved Rasulullah.
I want to be like you.
Like you.
In everything I do, Ya Rasulullah.
I want to walk like you, talk like you, read my Quran just like you, Rasulullah.
A'udhu billahi min shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters and dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You're welcome to this program, Like Muhammad, with me, Javed Akbari. Well, a true Muslim is one who adheres to the teachings of Islam based upon the teachings of the noble prophet, peace be upon him. We know very well that the Quran and the teachings of the prophet are the two most important sources for Islamic teachings. Those are the two most authoritative sources from which the Islamic legal rulings, the Islamic code of conduct are derived. The Quran being the most authoritative source, and the teachings of the Prophet is the next most important source from which we derive Islamic laws, we extract legal rulings. Of course, there are two other sources as well, which are less significant and less important as compared to the Quran and Sunnah. Now, in this program, Like Muhammad, of course, we are going to focus on the noble characteristics and teachings of the noble prophet, peace be upon him and his family. Before his mission, or before his prophetic mission, the holy prophet, peace be upon him and his family, was known for an impeccable character, an exemplary lifestyle. And the Qurayshi people who lived in Mecca, of course, as well as in Medina, of course, acknowledged him to be the trustworthy one. We talked about the Prophet being trustworthy in one of the previous episodes. If the modern-day Muslims embrace these flawless traits, now trustworthiness, honesty, and those noble and sublime characteristics of the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, of course, we would find the world a better place for all to live. There is no doubt as to the fact that following the lifestyle of the Prophet isn't something easy, in as much as it requires one to leave aside his whims and earthly desires. You know, one cannot follow his whims and desires and physical desires and still be a follower of the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family. The Prophet's lifestyle is characterized by discipline, which starts with a firm conviction in the sense that we have to believe in the path of the Prophet and his pure Ahlul Bayt. That's the first point. That was what gave the people, the companions of the Prophet, peace be upon him, felicity in this world and the next. And that is the thing that gives us, as the followers of the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, felicity and happiness and salvation in this world and the next. So bear in mind that nothing will fix our state, our present state, except returning to the Quran and the Prophet, and returning to his pure family. In doing this, you will face several challenges, problems, hurdles. Obviously, in order for a person to be able to follow the path of the Prophet, one has to make up his mind and have a firm resolution. Otherwise, success is not ensured. Success is not achieved. And it's also very important to develop knowledge and correct understanding before rushing to implementation and rushing to condemnation. Most of the problems facing the Muslim mass and the Muslim Ummah originate in their ignorance of the Islamic teachings. And most of the problems we face in this time around, in this modern age, is because of a lack of knowledge and because of ignorance of the teachings of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him.
بعد العسر يسرا ربنا أعلاك قدرا يا إمام الأنبياء يا حبيبي يا محمد يا نبي سلام عليك يا رسول سلام عليك يا حبيب سلام عليك صلوات.
In today's world, it is because of the practice of some so-called Muslims that a mere mention of the word Islam leads to misgiving and to dreadful feelings. It is not because the faith is associated with doubt or fear or violence or bloodshed. It is because of the practice of some ignorant Muslims. And of course, brothers and sisters, the religion of Islam is a peace-loving and easy religion. It is the religion of tolerance and mercy. It is the religion of compassion and forgiveness. You might have heard the story of Bedouin who ran into the mosque and deliberately passed urine inside the mosque. The people rushed to beat him up, but Allah's apostle told them to leave him alone. After the Bedouin relieved himself, the Prophet asked that water be poured over the place to cleanse it. He then explained to the Bedouin calmly, "This is a place of worship. In it is the worship of Allah and the reading of Quran is done." After the Bedouin had left, the Prophet, peace be upon him, said to his companions, "You have been sent to make things easy for the people, and you have not been sent to make things difficult for them." This is one example of the Prophet's mercy. Had it been left for the ignorant people, they would have killed that man who passed urine or who urinated in the mosque deliberately. But the Prophet forgave this man and ordered his companions to wash the mosque and leave him, that man, alone. There are too many examples of the Prophet, peace be upon him, forgiving his companions, forgiving other people. The Prophet's life about simplicity, about equality, about different, you know, there are different examples to be given. The example of Mu'adh ibn Jabal, who was a very young companion of the Prophet, is also to be mentioned here. Although Mu'adh ibn Jabal was opposed to Imam Ali's successorship, but he was one of the companions of the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, the Prophet sent him to Yemen to go and teach the people about Islam. On the eve of his departure, Allah's messenger, Allah's prophet, advised him by saying, make things easy for people and do not make things difficult, and cheer them up and do not drive them away. Make Islam look easy and simple in the eye of people. So try to motivate the people. And this was a piece of advice given to Mu'adh ibn Jabal, who was sent by the prophet to Yemen.
My heart is so full of longing. I wish to be close to my beloved. I dream to walk in the streets of Medina and to quench the thirst of my spirit by visiting you, O Muhammad. As-salamu alayka ya Rasul.
There is also another example which I would like to give you very quickly. The Prophet of Islam established a religion based on racial equality. He said there is no superiority for an Arab over a non-Arab, nor for a non-Arab over an Arab. The fair-skinned person is not better than the one with the dark skin, nor is the dark-skinned one superior over a fair-skinned. The one who is more pious and God-fearing is more deserving of honor. Inna akramakum indillahi atqakum. There are, brothers and sisters, many, many other examples which we can mention, which we can learn lessons from. And inshallah, we will follow the discussion in the following episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Be like Muhammad and live like Muhammad and give like Muhammad gave. Shafi'ullah, Habibullah, Nabiullah, Rasulullah, Khalilullah, the friend of Allah, ya Rasulullah, Rasulullah.
In the limelight.
In the United States, a jury on Tuesday, 22nd of February, found the three white Georgia men who murdered Ahmed Arbery guilty of federal hate crime, determining that they were motivated by racism when they chased the 25-year-old black man through their neighborhood. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Tariro Mazazewa, Audra Birch, and Richard Fawcett. The piece is titled, Three Men Are Found Guilty of Hate Crimes in Arbery Killing. A jury on Tuesday, 22nd of February, found the three white Georgia men who murdered Ahmed Arbery guilty of a federal hate crime, determining that they were motivated by racism when they chased a 25-year-old black man through their neighborhood. The case was one of the most high-profile hate crime trials in years, and came after a rash of acts of violence against African Americans, including Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd, led to protests and soul-searching around the nation. It was seen as a victory for the Justice Department, which has pledged to make such cases a priority. While legal analysis says the hate crimes are especially difficult to prove, federal prosecutors in Georgia, in the Georgia trial, presented voluminous evidence of the defendant's racist beliefs and crude language, leaving some jurors visibly shaken. It took them roughly 4 hours to reach a verdict. When it was read out, aloud in court, some jurors wept. National civil rights leaders hailed the conviction as a victory for racial justice in America. As the nation continues to grapple with racially motivated violence by police and vigilantes who shroud themselves in self-appointed authority, the jury sent a powerful message. We see you for what you are, and we will not tolerate your deadly campaign of intimidation, said Mark Morial, chief executive of the National Urban League. This verdict draws a clear line in the sand, he said. Ahmaud Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper-Jones, said she never doubted that the jury would find the defendants guilty, but her satisfaction was tempered with grief. As a mother, I will never heal, she said. They gave us a small sense of victory, but we will never get victory because Ahmaud is dead. In addition to the hate crime convictions, the jury also found the three men, Travis McMichael, 36-year-old, his father, Gregory McMichael, a 66-year-old, and their neighbour, William Bryan, a 52-year-old, guilty of attempting kidnapping, and found the McMichaels guilty of one count each of brandishing or discharging a firearm during a violent crime. The men now face up to life imprisonment for the federal crimes, on top of the life sentences they received in state court this year after being convicted of Ahmaud Arbery's murder, with only William Bryan eligible for parole. The federal convictions ensure that the defendants will receive significant prison time even if their state convictions are overturned or their sentences reduced on appeal. Most cases that local prosecutors and others ask the Justice Department to pursue do not end up this way. The department tends to be careful in selecting such cases, pursuing 17% of the hate crime incidents it was presented between 2005 and 2019. When the department does decide to prosecute, the cases usually end with defendants pleading guilty. In this case, prosecutors had initially reached plea agreements with two of the defendants, Gregory and Travis McMichael, that would have sent them to federal prison for 30 years. But Ahmaud Arbery's family protested the deals, in part because they would have allowed the men to serve their time in federal prison, viewed by some as less dangerous, rather than state prison. Judge Lisa Godby Wood ultimately rejected the agreements, allowing the trial to go ahead. She has not yet sentenced the men in the trial that ended on Tuesday, and it was uncertain whether they would start serving their time in a state prison for the murder or in a federal prison for the hate crimes. As a number of recent cases of violent crimes against African Americans have worked their way through the legal system, the Georgia case stood out for forcing a blunt examination of racism in the courtroom. On 23rd of February 2020, the three men used a pair of trucks to chase Ahmaud Arbery, who was running through their neighbourhood, until the younger, Mr. McMichael, shot him three times at close range with a 12-gauge shotgun. Over a week of testimony, federal jurors were exposed to ugly expressions of bigotry by the three white men, and then asked to decide whether those attitudes meant that they had gone after Ahmaud Arbery because of his race and colour. Lawyers for the three defendants argued that the men had not been motivated by racial animus, but rather because Mr. Arbery seemed to them like a potential crime suspect. Gregory McMichael's lawyer, A.J. Balbo, told the jury that Mr. McMichael had not been out to hunt down a black person on that day, but rather to go after Mr. Arbery specifically after a police officer showed him security camera images of Mr. Arbery entering a nearby house that was under construction. Mr. Arbery had entered the house numerous times in the weeks before the shooting, including the moments before the chase began, though there is no evidence he stole or disturbed the property inside. 12 days before the shooting, Travis McMichael had also seen Mr. Arbery outside of the house and had called 911, claiming he saw Mr. Arbery reach towards his waistband, a gesture, Mr. McMichael said, that made it seem like he could have been reaching for a gun. Prosecuting hate crime cases is considered difficult because the government must prove not only that defendants harbour racist views, but that their crimes were specifically motivated by bigotry. In this case, evidence of the defendants' racism proved to be both voluminous and harsh, including numerous uses of racist epithets and racial insults. The government's case, with its video of Mr. Arbery grasping for his final breaths on the pavement and testimony that the defendants did not render aid to him, seemed to take an emotional toll on jurors, some of whom could be seen crying. Last week, one of the jurors asked court officials if counselling was available. At the end of the day, the evidence in this case will prove if Ahmed Arbery had been white, he would have gone for a jog, checked out a house under construction, and been home in time for Sunday supper, Bobby Bernstein, a Justice Department lawyer, told the jury. Instead, he went out for a jog and he ended up running for his life. Instead, he ended up bleeding to death, alone and scared, in the middle of the street. After the verdict, one defense lawyer declined to comment and a second could not be reached. Pete Theodosian, lawyer for Mr. William Bryan, said he had been optimistic about his client's chances. "We'll have to respect the decision of the jury and move on from here," he said. The verdict was an important victory for the Justice Department. Attorney General Merrick Garland said at a news conference that today's verdict makes clear that the Justice Department will continue to use every resource at its disposal to confront unlawful acts of hate and to hold accountable those who perpetrate them. The death of Ahmed Arbery was met with revulsion from both conservative and liberal lawmakers in Georgia. It prompted state legislators to significantly weaken a citizen's arrest law that one local prosecutor cited soon after the shooting to argue that the three men should not be arrested. It also prompted them to pass a state hate crime law. This month, the legislature also passed a resolution declaring Wednesday, the second anniversary of the killing, Ahmed Arbery Day. Memorial events are planned in several cities in Georgia. As the verdicts were read out in court on Tuesday morning, Mr. Arbery's parents and other family members lowered their heads, some praying. "Thank God," said Marcus Arbery Sr., Ahmed Arbery's father. The only black man on the jury, who also served as the foreman, wiped tears from his face as the verdict for each charge was read. The woman seated beside him also cried throughout Tuesday's proceedings. "Ahmed Arbery will continue to rest in peace," said Wanda Cooper Jones, Mr. Arbery's mother, "but he will now begin to rest in power."
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't.
can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Despite COVID-19 and the hyped-up coverage of the pandemic by U.S. mainstream media, main cause of hospital and rehab admissions remains excessive consumption of alcohol, usually by adults, while the younger generation finds itself facing novel chemical drugs in the black market. Therefore, overdosing on dangerous drugs persists, and Americans continue living with a very serious drug problem. Destructive aspects of drugs available in American drug market has exacerbated today. Fentanyl, for example, is similar to morphine, although it is reportedly 50 to 100 times more potent. That offers another relative explanation for the rise in the number of overdose deaths.
And I just realized that maybe I'll give sobriety a shot, because the worst thing that could ever happen is maybe I'll be happy. Worst thing that could happen if I keep going is I'll die.
U.S. Hidden Epidemic.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. In this episode, we will delve into all the aspects of a much less reported epidemic in America, drug overdose. In today's show, I'll be accompanied by activist and commentator Stephen Young out of Lake City, New Jersey. And later in the program, we'll be joined by social justice activist and podcast host Cindy Sheehan from Vacaville, California. Together, we'll try to find out how much the drug overdose epidemic has changed in the U.S., who's the most impacted, and more importantly, what could be done about it by the government, the states, and the people. Stay tuned.
I can tell you that in the height of my addiction, my little brother overdosed. And when I say overdose, I mean me and him shot heroin together. And I realized he wasn't breathing. His lips started turning blue.
A determining factor in the spiking overdose deaths is the opioid crisis, which has been tearing the families and communities in the United States for a couple of years now. The crisis began by overprescription of drugs such as OxyContin to average Americans seeking treatment for health problems like chronic headaches. The move had been promoted by the big pharma in companies such as Purdue Pharma.
Now, while the company was brought down in courts, the powerful Sackler family has managed to escape all accountability. Sackler family still stands accused, though, of helping fuel the U.S. opioid epidemic. How much are powerful entities such as the Sackler family to blame for skyrocketing addictions and overdoses in America?
I want to blame the Sackler family almost completely for this, but they also had a lot of help. The Sackler family had a lot of deep ties to the FDA and local law enforcement. And so the Sackler family wanted to make a lot of money. They developed this so-called time-release painkiller they got the FDA to do something unprecedented. They put it on the label that it was non-addictive. And a lot of the doctors that they were, and then they used aggressive marketing techniques where the sales representatives for Purdue Pharmaceuticals, the Sackler family's pharmaceutical company, were taught how to lie to people, how to lie to the doctors. And they told doctors that it was not addictive. And the doctors are like, well, I never heard of an opioid that wasn't addictive. And at that time, there was a crisis in painkillers, people getting addicted to painkillers.
Opioid overdoses are specifically tragic as they're affecting people who are less prone to addiction. They just happen to refer to their doctor for mostly normal and benign health issues. It is therefore safe to say that they are victims of the medical industrial complex in the US, which has been obsessed with reaping benefits from the pharmaceutical industries with no regard for its repercussions.
It is really tragic. You know, we've seen cases in our own community. The people who get addicted to these painkillers, eventually their source dries up. And when my sister, for example, was suffering from cancer, and she couldn't get painkillers for her cancer pain, which was real.
And now Americans are facing a very serious crisis, which emanated from the complex internal politics of the healthcare juggernaut, where men on top make decisions about how to lead the sector in order to gain the most profits for themselves. So how could rising numbers of overdoses in the United States affect the current existing public health crisis?
Well, you know, the opiate epidemic has a lot to do with prescription drugs. And that's very key to drugs, period. Right now, a lot of young people have been taking drugs. So it definitely will affect, you know, people being able to function and work and provide for their families. Drug addiction in this country is it's almost like heroin, use of heroin. You know, heroin was the epidemic was very dangerous because people did anything to just get a needle in their arm. And these days they're doing anything to get a pill right now, even when it comes to selling their family if they have to. So this is very important, and they're hurting a lot of elders because they go to their parents and ask for so much money over and over again just to continue to get the drug.
To this day, families in America have had to pay the price for what Big Pharma has done. Overdoses also occur on the more powerful synthetic opioids such as fentanyl and meth, which are smuggled into America or made illegally inside the country. The response to the epidemic by the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has been deemed inadequate.
I think that it's tragic that almost everybody in the United States, including my family, including not a family member, but a close person that might as well have been a family member, have died from overdoses. Our friend, as a matter of fact, died from fentanyl overdose. But the president's son, you know, heroin and crack. And so it's this widespread problem.
The U.S. residents' budget request for the fiscal year 2022 calls for a $41 billion investment on national drug program agencies. The budget request offers a nearly $670 million increase over the one last year, and the administration claims that it will be spent on evidence-based prevention, treatment, harm reduction, and recovery support services.
Well, one thing they can start with, like I was speaking about, you know, the people that has experienced the most has been dealing the drugs as well as using the drug. They have more experience than the doctors that they have degrees. They have more experience than the people that went to school and colleges and university to learn about it and study about it. That's all you have to do is ask the average person who's been using that drug for 15 years, 10 years, 5 years, or a year, and how their effect was, and you can start turning it around because they can tell you from their experience. One thing you cannot take away from anyone or give anybody is experience, and you cannot take that away from them. And that's priceless, and we need to start using that towards the solutions in this country.
It's still not clear whether the huge sums of money could effectively turn the tide of the overdose epidemic in America. However, the administration acknowledges that getting rid of the pandemic entails collaboration between federal, state, and local law enforcement, as well as public health officials. Generally speaking, how could the U.S. government's so-called war on drugs really be assessed?
Well, as you all know, when the United States declares war on anything, it gets worse. So there was a war on cancer. Cancer has grown exponentially in the United States. There's a war on terrorism, which, you know, didn't do anything to defeat terrorism, but in fact caused many people to rebel or to rise up against the United States because of the United States actions. And this war on drugs is the same thing. I believe Nancy Reagan was really influential in starting the war on drugs. And since the war on drugs began, it's only gotten worse. And we can really combine the war on terror with the war on drugs, because since the United States invaded Afghanistan, the opiate supply has been much larger.
Now, according to some statistics, U.S. has seen a 50% rise in the cases of overdoses compared to the 1990s. This is in line with a sharp spike in recent street crimes, gun violence, and a widening political rift across the nation. Just like the big oil and big tech, the U.S. government is failing to take on big pharma.
We don't have a national health care plan here in the United States. In fact, my state, California, just shot down another chance to have some kind of public health plan here. And the bottom line is that the United States is captured by Big Pharma. You know, Big Pharma pays hundreds of millions of dollars to influence the media. They sponsor almost all of the legacy media here in the United States.
Myriad corrupt politicians appear to be bound to solely bow to the demands of the formidable industry and act like puppets in the face of their intense quest for profit. How could such overdoses impact the victims' communities and families?
These drugs has been out here for years, but it wasn't until it started hitting the white community that they started doing something about it. When you had a lot of white people from overdoses, such as judges' children, and lawyers' children, and so forth, when they started dying from overdose and opioid and everything, all of a sudden it became a lot of rehabs for people, for everybody. They had to make it equal now. Try to make it equal. They didn't make it equal, but they stopped a lot of things, such as a lot of arrests and how long they stay in jail, and started giving them rehab. Well, we've been asking for that for a long, long time.
Roughly 17,000 Americans died of an overdose in the year 2000, whereas the figure rose over 100,000 in 2021. The trend appears to be spiraling out of control, as a National Center for Health Statistics report showed in the last week of 2021.
Now, the shocking increase remains the largest year-over-year rate increase on record. And it's not difficult to assume the hidden epidemic has impacted certain portions of society harder, poor people, as well as communities of color like African Americans. So what should authorities do to address overdoses and generally the issue of addiction in America?
A lot of people come by their addictions because they got injured, right? They got injured at work. They got injured in a car accident. They got injured, however people get injured. And so they're prescribed these very addictive painkillers, which everybody was lied to, saying that they weren't addictive. And then what your body does is it creates pain so you can get the painkiller, right? And your body gets used to the dosage, so you have to take more and more and more and more.
Overdoses and other drug-related troubles keep inundating the more vulnerable portions of the society, and there seems to be no immediate remedy in sight. Consumption of drugs is targeted towards young children, who are most prized possessions of America. As more and more young kids die due to overdose, new adolescent arrivals are victimized by the legal and illegal drug industry.
Now, according to the 2020 National Survey on Drug Use and Health, 14.5% of Americans, that's roughly 40,300,000 people, had a substance abuse disorder in 2020. And the figure is at least expected to be lingering where it is, if not growing.
There are some serious things that we have solutions to, but are they working with the people that had the solutions? The solutions usually with the grassroots people, the foundation, the ones that's unheard, the ones that's not at the tables making these decisions. But like these young people hit the street with Black Lives Matter, they have solutions to a lot of things, but are they being listened to? I mean, I've been out here for over 30 to 40 years, you know, as a young man and getting older now. But have they listened to the solutions to being able to plan a city and create a home ownership and get rid of the poverty so we can have peace throughout the land? So as long as there are solutions, there should not be these problems in America.
Hard drugs are sold in the streets as traffickers are reportedly increasing the amount pouring into the country. It must not come as big shock that the overdoses have increased. A rise in the amount of hard drugs smuggled into the country simply signifies an increase for demand, which translates to a spike in overdose deaths.
Opioid crisis is one of the number one health issues in the United States. There's over 100,000 overdoses every year now. There's over $1 billion being spent on addressing addiction.
The hidden epidemic is indeed a grave national security and public health challenge for the United States and its officials. Overdoses are considered the cause of death for more people than car crashes, firearms, suicide, or homicide.
The FDA, the Sackler family, law enforcement who refused to prosecute the Sackler family or to even investigate the addiction, they're all involved in the crisis. And there were some people who really wanted this looked into, and they were stonewalled by the FDA, which, and it's just very interesting here in the United States.
The U.S. must rush to disrupt the flow of the illegal drugs into the country from overseas and crack down on middlemen as well as drug cartels, sustaining the supply chain for the illicit substances.
America always had a war on a lot of things, mostly a war against Black people. They did a war on drugs, a war on gangs, but they do a war on everything but poverty, you know. So, you know, if you don't straighten out the poverty in this country, how are you going to, you know, cure the violence and have peace? And that's one issue that America spends and wastes a lot of millions and millions of dollars giving it to the same people, mainly to millionaires. In this country, it is called corporate welfare when they get tax breaks for coming into poor neighborhoods and make a profit.
Not all overdose cases lead to deaths, yet the instance could still cause suffering for the addicts themselves, as well as their families and friends, for quite a long time. Lasting impact of the experience adds to the burden of societal issues emanating from addiction in general.
And we must stop using people as an experiment with these type of drugs as well. COVID-19 is shut down the entire world because nobody knew the cure. No one knew where it came from. How can that be when, again, you can go to the moon, but you can't figure out what happens right here on this earth?
And now we're going to check in with Abbas Motarim. He's going to speak about how the CIA put drugs into the Black community.
Today on Power to the People, we'll examine how the U.S. brought cocaine into the Black community as part of a larger genocidal war on Black people, as well as to fully destroy the Black Power movement. The United States of America's illegal imperialist regime, it is literally the biggest drug trafficker in the world, and even the CIA itself, it has the nickname of being the Cocaine Intelligence Agency, as the CIA, they literally funnel drugs into the country to destroy revolutionary movements, as well as to destroy Black communities. The United States, it declared an all-out war on the Black Panther Party. The government was willing to do anything and everything to destroy the party, as the government labeled the party as the biggest threat to national security. The government used the illegal FBI's COINTEL program to assassinate, to launch character assassinations, to lock up, and to torture black revolutionaries who were seeking to put power into the hands of the people, as that is where power belongs. The Central Intelligence Agency, they also had a major role in destroying the Black Panther Party. The United States, with the Cold War, they declared war on socialism, whether it was domestic or international, and they began launching coups and proxy wars to protect the corporate interests of imperialist America. CIA, also known as the Corporate Intelligence Agency, they did everything. They did everything in its power to destroy socialism. The CIA already had a war on the Black Panther Party, and in 1979, the people of Nicaragua, they had a successful revolution against the U.S.-backed Somoza dictatorship. The CIA, they then launched a war on the Sandinistas, who were a left-wing socialist revolutionary organization that just came into the power. The U.S., through the Central Intelligence Agency, they figured they could use one stone for the same target. The U.S. needed to fund the right-wing Contras to fight against the left-wing Sandinistas. But to fund a CIA proxy war, you need money. The Contras began funneling drugs to the CIA, and then the CIA, they began selling drugs to dealers within different black communities. Not only did this enact violence and terrorism against the people of Nicaragua, but it ultimately led to the defeat of the Sandinista government. And in the black community, crack cocaine, it became an epidemic. Now, if we put the Contra War and the destruction of the Black Panther Party into the proper historical context, we can begin to see the connection. As in 1979, the Contra War started and cocaine began being smuggled into the USA by the CIA. And then literally 3 years later, in 1982, the Black Panther Party was dissolved. The CIA literally put the final touches on the tactical defeat of the Black Panther Party by using chemical warfare against the black community. And its effects, it can still be felt today. Some might say, oh, here you go again, Abbas, with the conspiracy theories, you tripping. But literally the CIA itself, the CIA, they admitted to this, claiming that they quote unquote overlooked the Contras drug sales in the US. They also admitted to working with Contras, who were the ones dealing drugs. DEA field agent Hector Bareilles, he said, quote, I believe that elements working for the CIA were involved in bringing drugs into the country. Another DEA agent named Celerino Castillo III, he claimed that in the 1980s, the Ilopango Airport in El Salvador, which was used by the Contras to smuggle drugs into the country, he said that, quote, his attempts to investigate the Contra drug smuggling were stymied by the DEA management, the U.S. Embassy in El Salvador, and the CIA. And these facts have literally led to Hollywood making TV shows and movies about it, allowing media corporations to make money and get rich through shows like Snowfall that have dramatized what has happened. Crack in the black community, it has been devastating, and it's led to tens of thousands of deaths. The homicide rate in the black community increased, the fetal death rate increased, and there was an increase in low birth weight babies. And this also led to the war on drugs, even though the U.S. is the ones that put the drugs into the community in the first place. And this war on drugs, it was profitable. It created the conditions for mass incarceration in which black people are the most affected. And then they're subjected to slavery from mass incarceration through the 13th Amendment, allowing corporations to get rich. Now, there's more black men under correctional control than were enslaved. The effects of crack cocaine on the black community had been nothing short of genocidal. The inhumanity of the United States regime, the inhumanity of this regime, is a threat to humanity itself. This is Power to the People. I'm Abbas Luther King.
Now, in many cases, addictions end up ruining marriages, friendships, and careers. Unfortunately, out of the over 20 million Americans with at least one addiction in the United States, only 10% are actually treated and the rest stay on a perilous path, which could potentially end with an overdose. Well, I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and please join us again next week when we return with another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, parenting pathology. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the parenting pathology and what are the things that comes under this topic. The first thing that comes under this topic is the loss of the authority of the parents in the religious training of their kids. According to the Islamic teachings, what we can see is that the parents, especially the father and mother, and the father is the authority and is the guardian of the family. Even in the non-Islamic societies, parents are the guardians of their kids. Parents are the guardians of their own children. And in Islam, it has been emphasized a lot that the father especially is the main guardian and the authority in the family. And in training kids, in raising kids, the main role where the mother is playing her role, the father also have a specific role where he has to train the kids, he has to brought them up according to the Islamic teachings, and it is the duty of the mother and father. But the problem occurs when this authority no more remains authority over kids, when the kids are reaching to a specific age where they are no more following the sayings or the orders of their parents. And that is the time where obviously most of people, they refer or they consult different scholars, whereas this should not happen if they were aware of this loss, if they were aware of such pathology, then obviously they could have done something else before this stage, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of parenting pathology, and we said that the loss of authority of parents is one of the aspects towards which the parents do not have any attention. In the Islamic teachings, we see that Imam Ali alayhi salam has also said that the children have three rights on their father. Like, there are three things which the father should do. The first thing is to choose a good name for his children. The second thing is to train them in the best way. يُحَسِّنَ أَدَبَهُ, to teach him ethics, to teach him the best ethics and best etiquettes. And the third thing is وَيُعَلِّمَهُ الْقُرْآنَ, and to teach him Qur'an. These are the three things, the basic three things, which a father must do for his children. And this is upon the father to perform all these things. It is kind of an obligation, we can say, according to this hadith or the narration that we have. Therefore, if a father is not doing this, if he's not teaching them the good etiquettes or the good manners, ethics, even the Quran, and is not choosing a good name for them, then obviously when they're grown up, they can see that their father did not pay attention towards them. And then they can learn anything from anywhere else, which will result in not having the authority of father over the children. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Flying is one of the most carbon-intensive activities people can undertake, and ghost flights have angered those campaigning for action on the climate crisis. We now present you an article written jointly by Damien Carrington and John Vidal. The piece is titled, Until Airlines Tackle the Scourge of Ghost Flights, Britain will never reach net zero. According to newly revealed official figures, almost 15,000 ghost flights have departed from the United Kingdom. The ghost flights, defined as those with no passengers or less than 10% of passenger capacity, operated from all 32 airports listed in the data. Heathrow Airport was top, with 4,910 ghost flights between March of 2020 and September of 2021. Manchester Airport and Gatwick Airport were the next highest. There were an average of 760 ghost flights a month over the period, although the data covered only international departure and not domestic flights. Flying is one of the most carbon-intensive activities people can undertake, and ghost flights have angered those campaigning for action on the climate crisis. The German airline Lufthansa recently warned it would have to fly 18,000 unnecessary flights by March in order to keep its landing slots at airports. Under current rules, airlines lose their valuable slots if they are not sufficiently used. However, during the pandemic hit period covered by the new UK data, the rules that had required 80% of slots to be used were completely suspended. Airlines did not have to operate flights to retain the slots, but nonetheless flew 14,472 ghost flights. The UK Aviation Minister, Robert Coates, who produced the data in response to a parliamentary question, said flights may operate with a low number of passengers for a range of reasons. He added, since the onset of the pandemic, the government has provided alleviation from the normal slot regulations. This means that airlines have not been required to operate empty or almost empty flights solely to retain their historic slot rights. The Labour MP, Alex Sobel, who asked the question and is chair of the Net Zero All-Party Parliamentary Group, said, "To really tackle the climate emergency, we need to ensure that our aviation